It's the first of June. Lost my job and lost my room. I pretend to try, even if I try alone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jefferson Cowie, who's an associate professor of history at Cornell University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, The Long Exemption, An Interpretation of the New Deal from FDR to Obama, and Stayin' Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, which received the 2011 Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jefferson Cowie.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, we are speaking on the Labor Day weekend, and inevitably we are looking at the state of labor, and, of course, the statistics are so shocking and depressing in the sense that about 7% of the private workforce is unionized, and that number has been going down since FDR. Is this inexorable? Will there be a reversal of this trend, do you think?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. The slide has been going on really since 55. That's the peak of density of unionism in America. But then it was a general sort of gentle slide, and then it became precipitous in the late 70s and into the 1980s. And it's a decline that we have not ever recovered from. And it really speaks to a lack of organizing and a lack of vision early on in terms of the economy shifting from an industrial to a post-industrial economy and beginning to tap into workers in service and workers in information economies, women, immigrants, you know, all the people who make up the new working class.
So do you think that there's a possibility here in the United States, since so much of our mythology is based upon the American dream, anchored in the middle class, that there will be a political awakening? I don't know that's premature to declare the middle class dead, but it's certainly an endangered species.
Yeah, I thought the outlook might be a little bit different 2 years ago by this time, but it's just gotten worse and worse. And I think there already are signs, I believe, that people are beginning to take inequality very seriously as a very, very important issue in the United States. And most importantly, you know, you mentioned the American dream. As I joke to my students, the American dream is alive and well, but it's in Denmark, where, you know, social mobility has decreased in this country to the point that people are beginning to feel themselves stuck. And one of the core elements of the quote-unquote American dream was that you could, with hard work and pluck, you could work your way up the ladder. Well, the ladder rungs are now missing, and people are stymied and having troubles moving upward. And without the types of safety nets we see in other countries, we're not going to be able to. That's going to be those class structures that we try to avoid as a nation are becoming more and more reified here, while there's more mobility in the, you know, allegedly class structures of Europe.
Again, I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie. He's an associate professor of history at Cornell University and author of Stayin' Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. But is it possible, though, that when we talk about America, we should talk about two Americas? In many ways, it seems that the Mason-Dixon line is alive and well, the difference being that the Dixiecrats in the South, who used to be in the Democratic Party, now control the Republican Party, and they clearly have a presidential nominee in the form of Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's way ahead in the polls on the Republican presidential sweepstakes. So, his writings and thinking, if that's the right word, are so reactionary, it's shocking. But then you realize that this is a part of this kind of right-to-work Southern tradition of the plantation economy. So,
well, that's what's interesting about this is, you know, you're right, the history of the post-war period, post-World War II period in the United States has been as the South shifted from Democrat to Republican, and the Dixiecrats became Republicans, especially after the Civil Rights Act and things like this. But the other side of the story is sort of the Southernization of the United States. It used to be the South was the anomaly. It was, you know, it was the part of the economy and the politics that didn't make sense in the national narrative. Now it's become the national narrative. You know, whether it's, you can see it culturally, say in the popularity of country and Western music, which used to be a regional music, all the way to the way politics works, or that, you know, the Democrats lean on Southern moderate Southern Democrats to lead the party. So many of the cultural issues and the political issues and the economic issues have actually that define the South have actually been nationalized across the country, and so now it's there's pockets of regional pockets of resistance to that, but it's getting very, very scary to me how this works, and you know, the least of which is evangelical Christianity, which used to be a fairly regional phenomenon as well.
Well, one of the aspects of the Southernization of American politics has been this requirement for supermajorities, which
right.
came out of the Jim Crow era to keep the black majority down, and it becomes, you know, ruled by the minority. And of course, the Republicans are now deeply vested in this new constitutional amendment to have a balanced budget, which requires a supermajority. Again,
the single most important reform I think we can do is to get rid of the filibuster. Because you're right, the supermajority requirement that is basically inherent in any piece of legislation now came out of two issues. I mean, it was used throughout the 20th century for two issues. One, to maintain racial segregation. Two, to defeat any kind of progressive labor legislation. And until we get rid of that, and it's easy to do. It's just a rule. It's not in the Constitution. It's merely a procedural rule. It could be done away with tomorrow, but nobody will take it on.
Well, I was going to say it has literally hamstrung the state
completely.
Of California because of the two-thirds requirement in both budgets and revenues. And it has allowed a small minority of highly ideological Republicans to, in fact, rule in this majority Democrat blue state.
That's right. And you combine that with a hardening of those ideologies with a supermajority, and you have, and especially, you know, the Republicans show up to play, you know, they show up with chains and knives, and the Democrats show up to play softball, and you have a very scary situation.
But what's going to happen, though, in terms of just moving from the political reality, which is pretty dismal, and it is it is hard to kind of grapple with this disconnect between economic realities and political possibilities, and we seem to be sort of helpless and floundering at this moment. But presumably, you know, a lot of people, the biggest party in the United States is none of the above. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Democrat and I'm not
right.
a Republican. So there's some reason to have hope that there, at least there's some stirring out there. What about a stirring amongst the working class? What about the idea of reviving labor and people basically giving up on this quixotic notion that you can win the lottery, or you can, you know, if you your freedom is tied to a billionaire's right not to pay taxes.
Right. Yeah. There used to be something we called, you know, the working class that had some sense of shared collective economic destiny in this country. I argue in the book you mentioned in the 1970s it fell apart and a new one failed to reemerge that could bring together the new social movements of the 60s and the old class-based movements of the 30s into a new kind of vibrant working class movement. And so now we have very little tradition to build upon today. And I think that's both promising and problematic. It's problematic because we do have to start anew. But it's promising because we're not hamstrung by old visions and old shibboleths about how to make the country work. And I think that this is where I'm always criticizing the New Deal as, you know, what we need is a new New Deal, what we need is a new New Deal. I'm always trying to find new formulas, new approaches, new ways to ignite political and workplace actions that speak to our own time. And I'm still struggling to do that, and I'm not quite sure where their energy is going to come from. But if it comes from anywhere, I think it's going to be the immigrant working people of today. I think that's where a lot of the animosity from the right is coming, but I think a lot of the hope for the left is also coming, would be amongst immigrants.
And what about the different course that the United States has taken in compared to the other social democracies? You mentioned jokingly about Denmark earlier. It is puzzling to think that in a country that has a sort of basic bottom line thinking, that the average American does not is falls for the argument that they're taxed too much, as opposed to the real question is what happens to your tax monies and what do you get back, and that this basic transaction that's understood in other social democracies that you pay your taxes and you get your government services.
That's right.
And nobody thinks, I mean, the right has been so successful in demeaning the very role of government and leaving everybody at the mercy of the marketplace, which ought to be clear that that is a fate worse than death.
Right.
So how do you revive this idea? Because, you know, frankly, Social Security is a fairly simple, well-run system. I don't know what the hell all this propaganda is about. I mean, this Perry guy is talking about it as a Ponzi scheme. I mean, work? Are people that gullible?
Progressives really have to take seriously the anti-statism that is very strong in American culture. And it's very difficult to do, to simultaneously try and figure out ways to move forward while recognizing this kind of anti-statist impulse that is very deep in amongst citizens in the U.S. It's not, you know, it's not, I'm not trying to create some sort of cardboard cutout portrait of American voters, but I do think there is something there, and we have to be very careful about how we talk about these things. But my biggest hope for Obama, my only hope for Obama, actually, when he was elected, I never really thought he'd be anything more than a very good neoliberal president, and I think he's been a poor neoliberal president so far, was that he would begin to make the argument that the state had a place to, a positive role to play in people's lives. And I think the way you do that is you say, okay, what are the mechanisms for an individual to be able to rise in this country and to be able to make it. And it's through a set of collective resources, whether it's Social Security or public education or, health care, that these things provide a bridge between one particular individual's sets of hopes and dreams and a broader collective destiny. And I don't see those arguments coming out of Washington right now.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, professor of history at Cornell University and the author of Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. The Democratic Party, not to mention the president, seemed to be so supplicants, if you will, to Wall Street that they truly have lost sight of the history and heritage of the party. And particularly the 30s look what's happening now. The next Democratic convention is going to be in North Carolina, and the
right.
AFL-CIO are really furious because they're hosting them in all these non-union hotels.
Yep,
it just shows you that the party doesn't give a damn about the unions anymore because they don't have any money. Which is that's a self-fulfilling prophecy of doom, surely.
I agree. And I wanted to back up just a minute and talk about taxation and the role of the state, because all these presidential candidates since Reagan have been talking about rolling back the state, cutting the state, and the state's been doing evil things to you with your resources. But nobody has ever said who of these leaders who has actually reduced the size of the state. And the answer is none of them. The state has continued to grow across the board. The question we need to begin to pose is, whose side is the state on? And obviously, nobody's actually reducing it, so therefore the question is the state doing businesses, serving businesses' interests or the people's interests? And I think if we can begin to think about that a little more effectively, we might be able to begin to change the discussion. And I agree. It used to be that nothing could come out of the Democratic Party without union endorsement, the union bug on the literature, and the union hotels, the whole thing. And those days are limited. I think Rich Strumpf has been doing a pretty good job of arguing labor's points with the administration, but I think it's a little bit too late, and we're historically, and we're not seeing much in the way of mobilization around these issues, I think.
But I think the argument, when you talk about how the debate over the state should be revisited, but it also should be reframed. I mean, there are two narratives here, the right wing and the Republicans. Their idea is to use the state to transfer public money into private hands. And they've done that with gangbusters, and Bush has grown the government, but he's only grown it in terms of contractors and the Halliburtons. And, of course, the states, the state's just this big piggy bank. But it happens at the expense of real social services. And so we have right-wing welfare in this country, not traditional welfare.
That's exactly my point. It's like, okay, nobody genuinely reduces the role of the state. They just shift it to other sectors. The class war is actually alive and well in Washington, and they're doing a great job of siphoning resources to the types of contractors you're talking about, tax subsidies to the rich, the famous GE case where they not only didn't pay money, they received money from the federal government, and there's scores of other cases like that. GE's just become the most famous. Whereas, we need to cut services to the poor. We can't afford health care, but yet we can afford these wars. It's truly a looking glass kind of political discourse.
Well, just in closing, Jefferson Cowie, at times I wonder whether, given the ascendancy of Ron Paul in the Republican Party, at least in terms of the debates, obviously the establishment would like him to go away.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But he is raising some interesting questions about these ridiculous wars. We also were expecting, at least Karl Rove said that Sarah Palin was going to announce on Saturday, which she didn't. But what she did on Saturday at the Tea Party gathering in Iowa was rip into Rick Perry in an interesting way, which was using populism, talking about herself as a reformer against big oil companies, and that basically Rick Perry is just, he's got his hand out for every big corporation to, fund him, and basically attacking Perry. I guess it indicates that she's still in the race, but I was kind of amused to think, well, if the right wing in this country, if Sarah Palin can capture this kind of working class populist resentment against the big government, big business being able to buy a political candidate, they're welcome to it if the left is that useless that they can't step up.
Right. Yeah, that is the sad thing, that the left has failed its own populist traditions, I think, in that way, and that there is energy there. And that the people are suspicious about these things, and there is a chance to tap into that. Palin's playing off both sides of the issue, though. I think she's only viable as a potential candidate. I think when she's a real candidate, she's in deep trouble. But right now, she can sort of run a kind of this funny little reality show she has going on as a potential candidate. So Yeah, well, the example we're talking about is a little problematic, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not for one second thinking that she's viable or desirable.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a poster child for anti-intellectualism, but
oh my God.
There's plenty of that to go around, obviously.
Well, trumped only by Michelle Bachmann.
Well, thank you for joining us here on this Labor Day weekend.
My pleasure. I wish all your listeners a happy Labor Day.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Jefferson Cowie, who is a professor of history at Cornell University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, The Long Exception and Interpretation of the New Deal from FDR to Obama, and Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.